Hey Dave, here's my fourth, as in F-O-R-T-H, not F-O-U-R-T-H, back at you. I decided that you're back and I'm fourth, so that could be our code name for each other. Anyway, so I'm in my office here, and I'm responding to your most recent one, your second one. You mentioned that we're squaring each other, meaning we've done four of them so far, I think. Anyway, so this is my fourth. It's the 14th. Yeah, January 14th. And what I'm doing this time is I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm looking at Little Outliner. And I'm double-clicking with my left hand and my headings, and I listened to your thing, and I took notes live while you spoke, and in outline form on Little Outliner, and those are on basketball, and I'm doing it in kind of in reverse order, kind of a LIFO buffer approach, mostly because I want to get the health stuff out of the way first. This is sort of the more trivial stuff out of the way. Even as I'm speaking, I want to reorganize the outline, and I'll expand each section as I go through them, just as a thought experiment. First, on the subject of basketball, on believing if one can make the shots, that the chances go up. I mean, that's so key. You know, it may be an apocryphal story, but Wilt Chamberlain, who may have been the greatest basketball player ever, only one ever to score 100 points in a game, who every year would decide, I'm gonna lead the league in like rebounding this year. I'm gonna lead the league in assists. He was so capable, just an amazing player. He could not hit a foul shot. He was worse than Shaquille O'Neal. He was like a 10% foul shooter. And but the story on him was that he actually was a very good foul shooter in practice. He just wasn't very good in games. He was kind of a head case in the games. He just sort of was living proof. He would win bets saying, you know, I'll bet you I'm going to hit the next 9 foul shots. And people would take him up on it, you know, teammates and stuff, thinking that was a good bet for them. And then he'd hit the next foul shots. But then he couldn't hit them in games. So that's sort of an interesting thing. I want to add about my own basketball skills. When I went out again yesterday to my own little basketball backcourt here, and boy, did I suck. I mean, I am such a shadow of, I mean, I was never good, okay, but I'm a shadow of what I was. I'm an old guy. I literally do not have the physical tools to be anything like a real player. I mean, nobody is at my age, okay? They just aren't. People who really were good basketball players when they were young, it's not like golf or pool or a number of other sports where you can remain good into your later years. It's just not. And so the best I did was shooting like 30% for the foul line, 3 out of 10. But what the hell? I'll keep doing it. But I did take your advice on walking. So I walked I walked way up the hill. I live on a hillside here, about 500 feet up, and the top is about 1,000 feet. And so it's about a mile round trip, but it does involve a pretty steep uphill area, which I took in chunks while I was talking to my daughter on the phone. But I decided I have to walk. I just have to walk. So I did. And talked almost the entire time on the phone with my daughter, which is a good thing to do. Okay, on health, the next subhead, and on cutting losses, and on David Bennell. By pure coincidence here, I have a copy of Upside, the magazine he started, and from 1996, and everything in it is wrong. I mean, it's like what they were thinking about the future at the time was, for the most part, wrong. It was right along the lines of your, picking winners and losers, 50 hot startups, and so much of it is just full of shit. And all prognostications toward the future, especially in tech, are full of shit. And it's fun to play the game, but this is it's really sobering to look at it, especially considering the fact that David's gone. And you knew him better than I did. I knew him a little bit. And one of the ways that I knew him is that I was mistaken for him a lot. We were about the same age. He was a little bit older than me, I think. But once we're all adults, it doesn't matter a whole lot. But he wore a hat a lot. I never wore a hat, or rarely wore hats. And he wore glasses, and much of my life I didn't wear glasses. But there was something, you know, you said I look like Wilford Brimley. I actually look more like David Bennell. Another weird coincidence is that he died of pancreatic cancer, and I am at risk of pancreatic cancer because I had pancreatitis once. And that was caused by a bad judgment in a medical judgment on the part of how I was advised by a gastroenterologist for a procedure I didn't need that caused the pancreatitis, which in turn caused it to, you know, caused the risk to go up. It's not a high risk, but it's more than if you never had pancreatitis. It turns out I have a formation on my pancreas that turns out to be nothing. It's just like having, you know, a mole on your head. It's completely benign. But it's much more innocent than the simple fact that I've had pancreatitis. I've also dodged other bullets. I mean, in car accidents, I rolled a Volkswagen. It rolled over 3 times and I didn't die when I was 18. In itself was an interesting story because I walked away from it and learned a lot in the process. But another one was a pulmonary embolism, basically a blood clot that started somewhere in my body and ended up in a lung, passed right through my heart. Had it stopped my heart, it would have fallen down dead on the spot. But it did that for, say, Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune. He died of a pulmonary embolism. It was a nothing. It landed in my lung. It caused some referred pain. It got treated, and I'm not the worst for wear on it, but it was a bullet I dodged. Also, on your mom wanting another 6 years, I'm in good shape. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I know, and isn't it great that your voice doesn't change up to a certain point? I mean, I don't sound any different than I did at 25. But my face has. I mean, a horrible experience where I put on, we had a big crowd of people here over Christmas here in our house in Santa Barbara. And Joyce's family, Joyce, for those who don't know, is my wife. And she's the oldest of 8 in a big Irish family. And those families married into other big Irish Catholic families. There's just a whole lot of people on her side of the family. And they're all in California, too. So a lot of them are here. And I put up photos. I did an album that ran on our TV through Apple TV of our wedding and the wedding reception, which is, by the way, the best party I've ever been to. It was fantastic. And it was a giant family thing also here in Los Angeles. And people, before they knew it was the wedding, they're looking at all of Joyce's sisters and her brothers and relatives and talking about who's that. And they said, "Who's that?" Meaning me. They had no freaking idea that that was me. I look that much different than I did at 42. We got married when I was 42. And I look pretty much the same, you know, up until my late 40s, early 50s, I think. And then I just look different. I mean, it's not so much aging, it's just your body changes. And there, you know, I've gained and lost weight. I have no hair, almost no hair on the top anymore. That causes a lot. I had surgery on my eyes. It was not cosmetic, but it had cosmetic effects. It was to repair muscles in my eyelids. But in the course of doing that, it changed the look of my face. I see a lot better. I mean, there's less skin hanging down over my eyes than there was before, but I don't look the same. I look a little bit different. oddly, the facial recognition systems can spot me. So it's not like I look that much different. You know, Apple's thing says, we think this is you, you know, and it is. So that's an interesting thing. I have, you know, you said you have less longevity in your family than I have in mine. I have some record holders in my family, my grandmother to 108 almost, and my aunt to 101. But my father died 2 years younger than I am now. There are many family members in the larger family that, you know, my mother's younger sister died at 63, just had a stroke or something. Nobody really figured out what it was, but it was, and it was tragic. It was really bad. She was a great person, and it was one of those, a bad thing happened. Maybe that was a pulmonary embolism, you know, I don't know. But you know, Consumer Reports says an interesting thing about old drivers, that all of them think they're going to drive for another 10 years, whether they're 65 or 85. My aunt drove until she was 99 and quit driving only because she got tired of having to take the test again every year. But I think she also didn't trust herself, and 2 years later she was dead. So I don't have any... I mean, you know, it's what Gandhi said, or is said to have said, you know, live, you know, what was it? The work is if you to live forever. You know, it's a live forever, die tomorrow thing, you know. I'll have to look that one up. Look that up, people are there, you know, listening to this. There's that line about to live something forever and something tomorrow. If I wasn't holding a phone in my hand, I'd look it up. I'd hit pause right now and look it up. It's basically, it has to do, you know, with the leverage of one's work. And that's kind of the next thing. Oh, you said trust the universe. I agree. I trust the universe. Parenthetically, by the way, and I am on record as saying this, the universe is new. The universe is young. If the universe is going to live a few trillion years, which is kind of what the current science says, and we're only 13 point some billion years into this thing so far, and Earth itself is over a third of the age of that, and there are galaxies everywhere making stars like crazy, I think it's entirely possible, not just that we are perhaps the first intelligent life in the universe or intelligent planet in the universe, whether we are or not, it's early in this game. We are at the front of this thing. And I've been right about some other things. I years ago, I thought that spiral galaxies like our own had drains in the middle, and that's what made them spiral. And the drains are black holes. And since then, that's what the current science says. You know, galaxies like ours have a lot of black holes in the middle. I'm not bragging on this. I just think there's a perspective that I have that really has to do with the unimportance of my own life and the importance of what we're doing. And by that, I mean you and me. And the people who get what we're talking about and want to get what we're talking about. I'm at a stage in my life, I'm really doing nothing for vanity at all. I've never did, really, but it's really important not to have the vanity. It's very important not to have the humility and to know that, and to believe, you know, you said that you could not imagine failure with living video text. I can't imagine failure for the insights I have about customers, people, business, and markets. I believed, and I'm going to not make that the subject of this podcast because that deserves a longer one. I'm not even sure you get what I'm trying to do, Dave. I think you can. That's why, and you probably do, but you're one of the people I know would get it. So, and there are very few that do. You know, Craig Burton, who we both know, is another. Joyce is another. Some but not all of the people involved in Project VRM are others. But in much the same way as that people don't get outlining and don't get a lot of what you've been trying to do over the years and don't take the time to understand how tools should work or all that stuff. I think there are a handful of people that get what I'm talking about or what I'm trying to talk about. But I have absolute faith it's going to make a difference in the world. I have absolute faith that free customers are going to prove more powerful to themselves and to the world than captive ones will. And that's sort of a compressed way of putting it. But again, I'm going to save the rest of that. But I have faith. I do have faith. And that faith requires that I be not attached to surviving more past tomorrow. And I have faith that I have enough shit in the world already that if I did die tomorrow, the people who care about what I've been saying will, you know, pull it together somehow, what survives online. And you're right that the, you know, we don't have a lot of time. I mean, you know, it's whoever's, when the bill stops getting, you know, getting paid, then S3 is going to shut down and Hover is going to expire the domain names and the rest of it. You know, that's, there it is. And by the way, when you said the, here's the section of the outline that's getting into a groove. The best things I've done, nobody fucking uses. I feel the same way about a lot of stuff, but here's an interesting story. When I'll go to my grave as having been the guy who said markets are conversations, and which is the most quotable and often quoted line out of the Clue Train Manifesto. An interesting thing about that is that I was saying that for maybe 20 years before it went into Clue Train. And it really took the four guys that wrote Clue Train to make that thing work. And it really took the other guys who wrote that website and that book taking that jewel and putting it in a better case than it ever had before. You know, I mean, I used it when I was in the ad business and I used it in the PR business and I used it in just the writing that I did, but it didn't take. It did not take at all. It didn't take until it was in Clue Train, and Clue Train made it take. I think David Weinberger's Hyperlinks Subvert Hierarchy is a more powerful point than Clue Train, and much more radical and much more important. And I don't think, I think it's an obvious thing, yet I don't think many people get the full implications of it. There are a lot of lines like that, and not just in Clue Train, but in a lot of other places. And your point about Doug Engelbart's another one. You know, I mean, I met Doug only once, and he taught me immediately how to use that five-fingered thing. You know, that was amazing. And I got what he was talking about. He told me all about what he was trying to do. And I got why he was a lone wolf on that. And I think a lot of what he had to say is going to take decades before it fully sees, you know, use in the world. But I love what you're trying to do with this. You're, create a groove. And I'm going to unpack that headline. You know, and you're saying if it does... If it doesn't, I ain't doing it. If it doesn't create a groove, I'm not doing it. And just slowly give me tools. I'm using one of them here with a little outliner. I also have notes on using the outliner, which I'm not going to share with you verbally. But, you know, if you want to see them, you could probably, you can just go look at them, I'm sure. And looking for the right fit. I never thought about lack of titles. I would have jumped ahead to that one. You know, the... Because I got out of your blogging world and into the WordPress world when I moved from my old Manila-based blog to a WordPress-based one at Harvard, I didn't so much hate that. I just realized, well, now I need headlines. I need to think about what was the cost of that. You know, how, as you said something that really hit me, adding a title destroys meaning. Wow, I think it does in some cases. I think if I had to title every tweet, that would be ridiculous. But something I did on Manila, you may go back and take a look at this. We should both. I started using titles, but I had a technique, and it was one I really borrowed from Esquire's Dubious Achievement Awards, where the headline was the punchline. and you'd read the punchline, and then the blog underneath it, and that was the setup for the punchline. And I mostly experimented with that, and I'd actually forgotten until now that that's what I did. And I don't know. I mean, I could think more about it. I'll have to go back and check it and look at it. But I've gone back on many of my blog posts, including one I did a couple of days ago, where I changed the headline. The latest one, Lost and Found Stories. I really wanted to put in the world a whole bunch of stuff about dead ancestors of mine, for the sake of people who would care. There are very few. It got, I'm looking at my stats now, it has had 21 reads. Probably 8 of them are mine. It got one retweet and one like on Twitter. It got crickets on Facebook. Except from Mike Vizard. Mike Vizard, named VRM, by the way. He's a reporter. He grew up near Woodlawn Cemetery, where all his ancestors are planted in the Bronx, and had some fun things to say about it. But it wasn't about that. That was an interesting result. And that's one of those unexpected things when I look for with blogging, right, is that, you know, we get an effect, we don't get an effect, but it was cool. Anyway, I'm all for doing something new here, whatever it is. But anyway, you say I'm a writer, and that's how I process things. I guess I am too. I'm known for my writing, but I'm very visual. I'm a visual guy. I tell you a story, and maybe I'll close on this. I'll get ahead of the close and say I will watch Fargo, but I'll try and watch it with Joyce after. She's out of town right now after she gets back. So check that one off. But here's a story. When I dropped my daughter off at UC Irvine, she graduated from Berkeley, but she started at UC Irvine. I had not really been in spent any time in Los Angeles before, and I was there. My son was with me, her younger brother. We're driving back. It's an incredibly clear day, and I'm looking at the mountains. And the mountains, I mean, people who live in Los Angeles, I don't think appreciate that they have Alps. I mean, mountains, they go up to almost 12,000 feet above Los Angeles itself. Spectacular. And I'm from the East Coast, so I've lived in California longer than anywhere, but California is still exotic to me. The small 1,000-foot-high landform that I'm sitting on right now where our house is, if this were in Iowa, it would be a state park. Between here and Los Angeles, between Santa Barbara and Los Angeles, there are landforms that, were they in east of the Mississippi, would be national parks. And they take them for granted here. But I'm looking at those mountains, and I said to my kid, let's go up there. And I found the Angeles Crest Highway and Mount Wilson Road, and we drove up to Mount Wilson. But before we did that, we stopped at a store, at a fast food place. And I, the pockets in the doors of my car then, 1987 this was, were packed with maps, all from AAA. I'd go to AAA and I had maps of everywhere in California. And we sat while we were eating our hamburgers in this place, probably at McDonald's or something, and I studied the maps. It was not long after the Whittier earthquake, and I was curious about that because I'm into geology, and we went up to the top of Mount Wilson. I'm into towers and antennas and things like that, so I was looking at that stuff too. But I'm standing up there and I'm pointing out to the kid and anybody else is by, you know, what's going on. The view there is spectacular. It's not only spectacular, you're looking at more people than you can see from any vantage anywhere on Earth. Probably 25 million people are within sight of Mount Wilson above Los Angeles. You're about 6,000 feet up, which is like as high as the highest parts of the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Appalachians. And I'm just pointing out what's below. And then this car comes up and parks next to us. And there's four guys from New Jersey. They're coming from golfing. they're older guys, they're younger than I am now, and they've all got their jackass pants on, you know, with the plaid pants and the whole like, golf outfit. And they're totally New Jersey, you know, hey, you know, what's this, what's that over there, you know? And I'm telling him, I said, well, that the Rose Bowl is down there, you know, that's Mount Verdugo on the other side of it. Yeah, the Rose Parade's down there. It's on Colorado Street in Pasadena. That's Pasadena there. That's Glendale over there. Where was the earthquake? That's over in the near Whittier. It's called the Whittier Quaker. There's the Puente Hills over there. The islands out there, those are the Channel Islands. There's Catalina. You know, like the song, and that's Palos Verdes Peninsula over there, and there's downtown. You can barely see it, and you know, there's the Foothill Expressway, and they asked me, how long have you lived here? And I said, I've never been here before in my life. How do you know all this shit? I said, I studied a map. That's what I did. I read maps like other people read books. And my point with that is that I'm very visual. I'm very three-dimensional. I'm very geographic. And I understand everything geographically. I need a map in my head. I know where north is. I'm like a bird that way. I know where north is right now. Where I'm sitting, I'm looking south. There is the sunrise to my right. That's west. Behind my back is north. I got to know this stuff. And it's probably of no importance except as a, you know, a minor possible insight into how I work. Anyway, so that's probably enough for right now. And and it's a fun exercise in using an outliner. And I realize that I've skipped a whole lot of things that I had written in there, but at least I got the headlines. So 26 minutes, that's too long anyway. More later.